senior center in Fairbanks helps citizens make connections to get the care they need. Jean Kingray, the director of the North Star Council on Aging, says all it takes is a phone call.
I'd like to see more seniors who are physically healthy but feel kind of cut off coming to the senior center or other places where there may be seniors gathering, like the Mary Sai. Doing things that help those seniors to stop being so isolated and feeling alone, and finding out that there's a number of us out here that are willing to help and really want to make friends and help them to achieve whatever it is they want to do for themselves.
Meals on Wheels, van transportation, and personal care attendance are just some of the services available to seniors. This week, the American Association of Retired Persons is sponsoring Connections for Independent Living Week. Locally, the AARP and Alaska Cooperative Extension are teaching money management skills to interested elders. And Kingray says living at home can be a smart financial move.
Because it costs less. It only costs about $13,000, or I should say approximately $13,000 a year to keep a senior in their own home, and it can cost as high as $85,000 to keep them in a facility strictly for the aged person who needs care.
An active volunteer program in Fairbanks also puts people who want to help in touch with those who need it. And as Kingray says, what goes around comes around. Sharing a skill such as sewing or woodworking with others may make it easier to ask for help. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Down at the Southside job site, the walls are up and the roofs are on two houses that youth-filled Fairbanks is putting together. During a recent community tour, Lee Hunt, one of the program's trainees, says a few futures are taking shape as well.
I learned how to put the trusses on and the proper procedure to do that. And then the shooting the plywood, I've learned the safest way, you know, to be on the roof and how to walk on the roof, you know, and stuff like that. And I learned with the floor joists are and stuff like that, and how to put them on and the proper measurements and stuff like that. It's like, if I would have never came to youth build, I wouldn't have known that. I mean, I talked to all my friends, and even my friends are amazed, like, wow, you know? Because I used to not be one who'd really even get into stuff like this, you know? But then now, all of a sudden, I'm into it. I'm doing the deal and just loving it, you know? It's pretty neat.
Hunt says the two crews are aiming for a February 10 final inspection, and everything's on schedule. Once finished, the houses will be put up for sale. 4 months into the program, Youth Build held an open house and publicly recognized the achievements of Hunt and several other trainees.
My mother was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, and she never finished eighth grade. But she wanted something better for me. And she used to always say, if you reach for the stars and you settle for the moon, you got off the ground. So we started Reach for the Stars Award. For exemplary, as a leader who respectfully articulates concerns, always regards her peers and supervisors with sincerity, takes initiative, follows through with personal and program goals, and sets standards of excellence for herself, those around her, and the program as a whole. Mrs. Natalie Lunsford.
While you still have programs in 34 states, this year is the first for Fairbanks. Program Director Maureen Carey says since May, the original group of 29 trainees has shaken out.
We're now down to 18, and the ones we have are positive, they're committed, and they're here for both the education and the construction. They know that they need to take the whole aspect of learning in the classroom as seriously as the construction hands-on stuff.
Carey says as much as the trainees are learning, the staff is as well. For instance, the students need room to focus on what they're doing.
Some of the people that personality-wise and skill-wise mentally we thought would be here for sure the whole year are gone. We lost them just because they couldn't get out of bed. They were struggling with two jobs. They could pay their rent because they weren't from Fairbanks originally, and so they had to come in from outside, find a place to live cheap enough, and try and make it on their own without the support structure in place before they started.
Carrie says next time the program looks for new trainees, staffers will shrink the recruitment area to reduce the stress of moving to a new place. But that depends on whether the program continues. Youth Build is financed by a federal grant and supported by several local social service agencies. It costs roughly $20,000 for each graduate, though organizers are quick to point out that's less than the military or prison to other options available for unemployed, undereducated young adults. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Psychologists are often called healers of the mind, pastors likened to healers of the soul. While the two callings may seem related, they have not always seen eye to eye, says R.J. Ross, a founder and president of Denver, Colorado's The Samaritan Institute.
Modern psychiatry or psychology was pretty much acknowledged to be founded by Freud, whose position was either neutral on religion or anti-religious, depends on what point in time you talk to him. A combination of a founder that didn't deal with religious issues and training programs that really didn't train people how to integrate religion into the therapy, largely that was just not part of the training, even until recently.
On the other hand, says Ross, often counselors at churches are not trained to diagnose and treat serious mental and emotional illnesses. He says his group was formed 22 years ago to bridge the two camps, and earlier this year, it attracted a broadly based Fairbanks coalition of clergy and caregivers. Marvin Bergeson is a pediatrician and board president of the fledgling Samaritan Counseling Center. He says the Samaritan approach balances religious and clinical concerns and trains well-rounded counselors.
And one of the problems that's been present in Fairbanks is there's a number of people calling themselves pastoral counselors, and they're not certified or trained or licensed, and they're doing counseling, and in some cases doing more harm than they are good. And this would give us a handle on that, provide a good service, and allow us to educate clergy in the area so that we, not only would we do counseling, but we'd be an educational to help clergy that are here to do more effectively what they're already doing.
Lutheran minister Philip Kienert echoes Bergeson's point. Kienert is also a Samaritan board member and holds a doctorate in pastoral counseling. He says counseling is one of the most rewarding tasks spiritual ministers perform, but it's risky.
Not only is the pastor the person's pastor, but the pastor then also becomes a person's psychotherapist, in which transference and other dynamics begin to play, which are really not conducive to the pastor-parishional role.
That risk underscores the need for training, Kienert says, but he adds a qualified pastoral counselor can be one of the most effective therapists today. The promise of the new center excites him. Samaritan will assist clergy and offer counseling for $75 an hour, well below standard rates. Donated space from area churches and financial help from various denominations will make it possible for Samaritan to assist those who can't pay for services. Before the center becomes a reality, though, Kienert says the board is trying to raise enough money to pay for a director. But he says sizable donations from organizations and locals put an opening date for the center in the near future. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Before plants and animals can gain protection under the Endangered Species Act, scientists must first verify the threat through population and habitat studies. That's expensive and can take several years. Since the act was passed 23 years ago, some species have received protection, but far more ended up classified in one of three candidate lists where they waited for further evaluation. Federal Fish and Wildlife biologist John Nichols says that list got too big.
In Alaska, the Category 2 candidate list included a total of about 35 species. Nationwide, the list was something over 4,000 species. And part of the problem with that list and why the Category 2 candidates were done away with as a list was the concern that a misrepresentation or misunderstanding that these were all species that the Fish and Wildlife Service was planning to list eventually under the Endangered Species Act. That was not the case.
So last summer, the service changed its policy and now only keeps one list of candidates. The other lists of species biologists are concerned about have been turned over to the Nature Conservancy. The Fish and Wildlife Service will still contribute information and money to keep that list current. Officials say that will give them a good snapshot for potential candidates, and when development plans infringe on the habitats of these species, they'll still be informed. The changes are out for public comment. Citizens have until October 17th to offer suggestions before the policy becomes law. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. University policy expressly guards a long list of groups from discrimination, including Vietnam vets, parents, and pregnant employees. But the Board of Regents Friday afternoon shot down the latest effort to forbid discrimination based on sexual orientation. Earlier in the day, members of the public, students, and faculty spoke in favor of the change. Juno Building Inspector Sarah Besser says the university has a special responsibility to welcome everyone, a responsibility they've shirked.
I'm part of a group that faces attacks every day from the media, some religions, and others. In fact, many people insist we be mistreated. As a result, I look to any organization's policy to see if I feel welcome at the door. When I see myself listed, when I hear my name, I do feel welcome and I feel safe. But when I look to the welcome mat and don't see my name, I have reason to fear, especially when my inclusion has been specifically voted down before.
Besser points to action Regents took in 1993 to avoid language specifying sexual orientation by making it policy that employment decisions be based on an individual's qualifications and performance. But neither Besser nor students in campuses across the state were happy with the compromise. Student Regent Joe Hayes brought the issue up again last year. And after lengthy discussion and parliamentary procedures, the vote to include specific language was defeated last Friday. Hayes says it's the last time he'll raise the issue.
The situation now, I have three meetings left on the board. I think the board as a whole, with the 6-5 vote not to even discuss the issue, pretty much feels that, as far as they're concerned, the policies that we currently have in place are more than adequate for the whole issue of sexual orientation. And with all the other important issues going on right now for the university, I think an issue that can divide the board and is so divisive right now is not in the best interest of the students, staff, faculty, especially trying to go down to Juno and gain $15 million more for our operating budget.
Board of Regents President Mike Kelly agrees with Hayes, but he says students on campuses probably won't let the issue go.
Well, I think there are some people that have that issue on their agenda, and they're going to keep pushing for it. And sure, I expect we'll continue to hear from individuals that would like to add it. So the issue is certainly one that is going to remain out there.
For now, Kelly says the Board of Regents have a major budget package to promote, and trying to convince the governor and legislature to support the $335 million six-year plan will be difficult. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
The three existing charter schools in the state will compete for portions of the grant worth nearly $650,000 this year. Community groups planning new programs will also have a chance at some of the funds. The school groups will submit proposals next month, and the money should be distributed by early January. Nick Staybrook, planning director for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, says the Chinook Charter School wants some of that money to replace the $100,000 operating costs allocated by the school board last year.
Hopefully, with the grant available, we'll be able to apply to the state of Alaska for any costs that are over and beyond the amount of money we would get through foundation formulas. So hopefully, too, the $100,000 allocation we made to Chinook that was over and beyond what was required by the charter school law. Hopefully that money would now be coming from state sources or federal sources as opposed from the local source that it was last year.
The money comes under a federal education program which aims to promote and encourage new and existing charter schools. Alaska is one of 12 states receiving nearly $9 million worth of first-year grants. And educators anticipate future federal funding of charter schools through the Goals 2000 and other programs. Staybrook says setting up Alaska's first charter school was frustrating. In order for the state to be eligible for the available federal money, alternative schools had to already be operating.
It was kind of a catch-22 we were in that we needed the additional money to help the startup for our charter school here, but we couldn't get any federal money because we hadn't already had any in existence. Now that there are three charter schools in the state of Alaska, we were eligible for and apparently did obtain the federal money.
The legislature decided that up to five charter schools could exist in the Fairbanks district. Staybrook says no other groups have formally applied yet, although about 10 people have picked up information packets since last spring. State Charter School Liaison Darby Anderson says Alaska's Charter School Act depends on local involvement, and this money will make it easier for other groups to get started.
One of the emphasis of the legislation in Alaska is the process and procedure goes through the local school district, so it's in collaboration with the local district in terms of trying to come up with some innovative practices. So this money will support ways to help better implement those practices, and sometimes there's just additional incentive that is needed, and this is to help do that.
Anderson says the state will hold public hearings on charter schools sometime this month to get feedback on the program. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Prince William Sound Community College and the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company have always had a working relationship in terms of local oil spill prevention and readiness training. But this week, they're teaming in a much bigger effort. Sharon Hillman works for Alyeska and is vice chair of the steering committee that put together the oil spill symposium.
We have some educators coming in from Scotland who are really renowned for their interface with the oil industry. We have people who work with oil spill response in the North Sea and in the European areas coming in for the conference. We have people coming in representing the oil spill co-op associations across the United States and across the world, in addition to the exhibitors and a very good cross-section of folks right here from Valdez and from Alaska.
Alyeska's Hillman says the symposium's four-day agenda includes lectures, panel discussions, and tours of the Valdez Marine Terminal and port facilities, from a presentation on the psychology of risk to an actual spill response demonstration. Steering committee member Scott Thompson of Prince William Sound Community College says oil industry representatives and monitors alike are exhibiting the latest in oil spill prevention and cleanup.
I think probably one of the highlights and something that's really going to bring the people in at the beginning is a major on-water demonstration of response equipment. And so all the participants will go out in boats and they'll be able to view major equipment deployment, look at the hatchery protection plan as it's deployed, helicopter overflights, and then get a tour of the Port of Valdez as well.
Scott Thompson. Alyeska's Hillman says it's that kind of response capability that puts Valdez at the forefront and makes it an ideal location for the oil spill conference. As senior contingency plan coordinator with Alyeska's Ship Escort Response Vessel System, or SERVS, Hillman is familiar with the ambiguities of moving oil tankers safely through dangerous and fragile waters.
We have the world's largest oil spill prevention and response center here, and we are extremely active in both the issues of prevention and readiness, but also in trying to gain knowledge about what is best. Not all of the answers to any of these questions are the same for different places. So we do have to be very careful in looking at these issues to make sure that you ask the right questions up front, and that's part of the idea of bringing all this expertise together.
Alyeska serves Sharon Hillman. Hillman and other Alyeska personnel are among those sharing safety and response practices throughout this week's Oil Spill Prevention and Readiness Symposium. The symposium runs through Friday at the Valdez Civic Center. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
After enduring a storm of advertising from pro and anti-sale advocates, Fairbanks voters put their trust in city officials and agreed to sell the municipal utility system. 6,500 people turned out to vote. More than 3,500 approved the proposition, taking a 53.5% majority. Pacific Telecom consultant Brian Rogers says with all the advertising against the sale, the outcome was unclear to the end.
We were scared in the last week. We saw the barrage of advertising against the sale, and I think there were real concerns by all the parties that it could go down as a result of that barrage. I think a 9-point margin is a real big one under the circumstances, and we're very pleased that the sale will go forward.
With the voter approval, the machinery will start moving to carry out the deal. That means PTI will buy up the phone system and move 100 jobs from Anchorage to Fairbanks. The company plans to build a new office in town with groundbreaking expected next spring. Golden Valley Electric will start serving electric customers, and Fairbanks Water and Sewer will start serving city residents. Much of the transition will begin next summer. Sale opponent Juanita Helms says a combination of money and clout put the deal through.
The people that proposed to buy the utilities had a lot more money to spend on advertising, and they sold a lot of the leaders in the community that it was a good idea, and that probably had an influence over voters.
Helms says while many people objected to the process that put the deal together, it apparently wasn't enough to derail the sale. After adjusting the voter rolls to reflect true population, turnout ran just over 40%. Of those, a majority agreed to give the borough power to regulate bar hours and to close bars at 2 a.m. on weekdays and 3:30 a.m. on weekends. Voters also approved language to tighten the tax cap and extend animal cruelty laws to critters other than dogs. In the North Pole elections, more than 60 people were nominated by write-in. Former Mayor Carlita Lewis garnered 27 write-in votes. John Arnold and Craig Lewis each received 10. The council has 2 open seats and no declared candidates. To be filled, the nominees must accept the job. Ties are broken by a coin toss or by drawing straws. Surprisingly, no one nominated Santa Claus. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Eyes are on the city of Fairbanks today as voters determine the future of the municipal utility system. Pro and anti-sale advocates have swamped the airwaves and other media, spending close to $100,000 in the effort to sway voters. That makes this the most expensive local government proposition Fairbanks has ever seen. At stake is a $160 million offer to privatize the city-owned water, sewer, phone, heat, and electric systems. A second proposition would put the sale proceeds into an endowment to pay for city expenses. Pacific Telecom and other business owners are pushing hard for the sale. Their spending is challenged by hotel owner Dennis Wise, who put up $40,000 to finance the opposition. UAF political science professor Jerry Macbeth notes a curious coalition among opponents.
You've got people who ordinarily ought to be in favor of privatization, of letting private corporations manage and sell utility services, along with those who have been traditionally supportive of the government's doing it, the city government's doing it.
City voters will also choose 2 city council candidates. While the MUS sale is open only to city residents, people across the borough will have their say on setting bar hours. Proposition A would establish area-wide hours in the city and borough, closing bars at 2 a.m. on weekdays and 3:30 a.m. on weekends. McBeth says along with the MUS sale, the bar hours proposition will encourage turnout.
That's a proposition that influences so many other variables. It's a sort of a private property rights issue. It's a government power issue. It's a moral issue. It brings all these forces together.
A second proposition extends the borough's animal cruelty enforcement powers to animals other than dogs, and a third proposal tightens the current tax cap. Voters also have the usual races to decide today. 3 seats are open and contested on the school board. 4 seats are at stake on the borough assembly. The city of North Pole also has 2 propositions, one to amend the city charter, a second to bond for sewer improvements. Although the North Pole City Council has 2 open seats, no one's come forward to run, leaving the race open to write-in candidates. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
You could read this election as a mandate on growth. The top vote-getter here was Pam Robinson, the wife of a Park Service employee. She supports slow growth and opposes turning this tiny town at the foot of the Alaska Range into a tourist destination for large tour groups. The other slow growth candidate, Billy Fitzgerald, also won a seat. But residents also placed Jim Okunik on the council. He's one of Talkeetna's most outspoken proponents of industrial tourism. He garnered about a third less votes than Pam Robinson. Also elected was Myron Stevens, an 80-year-old longtime Alaskan whom many respect because he's still here and able. Tuesday's election results indicate that in this tiny town where people can rattle off each other's phone numbers without thinking, issues took a back seat in their decision about which of their neighbors should represent them to the outside world. More important is that both slow-growth candidates are nice people, well-respected, and good listeners. The same can be said of Jim Okunik, the former owner of K2 Aviation, who wants to expand Talkeetna's economy. The Talkeetna Community Council is advisory, but the Matsu Borough takes its decision seriously. It's the only voice this unincorporated community has. In Talkeetna, I'm Johanna Urich.
Over 200 people attended the community meeting last Friday in McGrath. Over 20 people testified. All were in favor of wolf control. McGrath resident Ted Almasy says he believes Governor Knowles listened to the concerns of those attending the meeting, but there's no doubt in his mind that the governor is resisting giving his approval for the controversial wolf control program.
I think he understands our side of it, but the political side of it is stronger than our side. You got all of these outside social clubs that are contributing to the political process here in Alaska. Anybody that runs for office has got to have money to run for office. And most of the money's coming from these PACs and these outside units. And sure, the voters put them in office. They may have some obligation to the voters, but they got an obligation to the people who put up the money.
Ted Almasy, former guide Jack Smith, says he thinks political concerns are interfering with good game management. Smith spoke at the community meeting last Friday and left the meeting unimpressed.
I think he waffled an awful lot. I don't believe that he really left the meeting with much of a different opinion than maybe he came with. I think he's going to do what is not, from a biological standpoint, correct, but what he's going to do is something that he's going to feel is politically correct.
Smith says McGrath and the surrounding communities have very few voters in comparison with the rest of the state, and he believes the governor might cave in to pressure from groups who are opposed to any form of wolf control. Although generally delighted that Governor Knowles took the time to travel to McGrath, most of the people here who are in favor of wolf control are pessimistic that the governor and state officials will act in time to allow for a successful wolf control program for the 1997 season. Governor Knowles says he will make a decision by next March. In McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
A recent ribbon cutting at what's referred to as Dock Point near Valdez Harbor officially opened a half-mile gravel and boardwalk interpretive trail featuring dramatic views of Prince William Sound and the surrounding mountains. It also marked the opening of shoreline access trails, improved parking and restroom facilities, and a potable water source for the public at a popular salmon fishing area at Allison Point along the road to the pipeline terminal. The two projects were paid for with over $600,000 in monies from the Exxon Valdez criminal settlement distributed by the State Department of Natural Resources. The city rec sites will complement a planned 8-mile state trail from Valdez to Chute Bay and some 40 other marine park projects statewide. James Winchester of the Prince William Sound Economic Development Council, which managed the projects at Dock and Allison Points and similar ones in Cordova and Chinega, says the kind of access they provide has been a long time in coming to an area where nature can be hard to reach.
People are always looking for an outdoor recreation opportunity in terms of the local residents.
And I don't know how much hiking you've done off the trails in this part of the world, but it's really tough to get anywhere if there isn't a trail. It's tough to get up out of the lowlands. It's tough to get up a hillside. So trails are really necessary to get outside, and there really aren't that many trails around here. So for the local residents, I think it's really, really important that we get out and build some hiking trails.
Lisa von Bargen with the Valdez Convention and Visitors Bureau says the easier wilderness access Winchester describes should also improve the Valdez community's appeal to a growing and lucrative group of baby boomer tourists.
They're a group of people that's more interested in learning about the area that they're traveling to and getting involved in their surroundings and the environment. And one of the things that they look for is what's called a soft adventure, getting out on trails, looking around, being able to do something that is that's exciting but that's not too taxing.
Von Bargen and the Valdez Convention and Visitors Bureau are seeking funding to develop an historic trail which runs from Old Town Valdez to Valdez Glacier. But with monies from the Exxon Valdez criminal settlement slated for such projects drying up, Valdez area trail users recently united to form the Valdez Trail Association as a means to support existing trails and help fund the development of new ones. Valdez Trail Association member Nancy Lethko says cooperative efforts are planned or underway for various regional projects.
The trail that I'm really enthusiastic about, and I think it would make a wonderful addition to Valdez for both local residents and for visitors, is a trail from Thompson Pass, following the old military trail down to Keystone Canyon, and then we've already got most of it in place, straight into Valdez. That's the kind of trail where people could fly into Valdez, stay in a B&B or a hotel, take a taxi or a van up, hike part of it, come back, spend the night, go out to a restaurant in Valdez, go up and hike the rest of it the next day. It's a wonderful, it must be one of the most spectacular routes in the world. And I think it's something that would make this a world-class attraction for Valdez summer visitors.
Lethko and the Valdez Trail Association have already begun work brushing out trails in time for ski season and the next grant application. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Borough Landfill Director Richard Bonwell says there's no charge when residents drop off their household hazardous waste, ranging from paint to cleaning fluids. These chemicals would otherwise end up in the landfill, possibly leaching into the groundwater table. But Bonwell says it's small business owners who are seeing the best results from the new system. They can drop off up to 220 pounds each month for a fee.
It varies depending on what they actually bring, but it equates to about $1 a pound is basically what it is. So if they had the maximum amount every month, 220 pounds, then they would be looking at about $220 a month. That is, if any businesses that have looked into contracting directly with a disposal contractor will find that that's a good deal.
Private industry could charge up to twice that amount. Hazardous waste workers handled almost 64,000 pounds of materials last month. Used oil heats the landfill buildings, while other items are stored until they're shipped out of state. September's numbers are the first available since the new program kicked off in August. In the past, residents brought hazardous waste to the landfill for collection only one weekend a year. Bonwell says about a third of the users are making appointments for the available Friday and Saturday time slots to drop off their items. He says the rest have had to wait in line.
Friday night we only had 3 appointments for Saturday, but they had 22 people through here. So there were a couple of times on Saturday where people came and there were 5 or 6 at the same time, and so they had to wait a little longer because we weren't expecting them. We still encourage people to make appointments. We think that we're able to get them in and get them out quicker. It makes our operation a little smoother, but if they show up and we let them stay and they are in the line, and when we finally get to their turn, then we take care of them.
Residents are dumping some used oil and other hazardous waste at the transfer sites. Managers want them to come to the landfill, but Bonwell says a borough employee is picking up those materials daily. Future landfill improvements include revamping the reuse areas at the transfer sites. A local bidder will construct concrete platforms with roofs to protect the reusable items from the weather until some lucky shopper picks them up. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Getting to the tiny town of McCarthy and into Wrangell-St. Elias National Park isn't easy. First, it's a slow 60-mile drive over washboarded old rail bed, then a hand-operated tram ride across the roiling Kennecott River, and finally a short hike into town. As park visitor numbers have climbed above the 20,000 mark and congestion has hammered home the need for improved access, once resistant locals are softening to the idea of change. Carly Critchin is president of the McCarthy Area Council.
I guess I've been here long enough that I've seen the change in the traffic into McCarthy. And when I first started coming out here, the traffic was fairly light, and you'd get a few visitors coming out. And I really think it has evolved this year into people come out, the road is terrible and rough, it's hot, dusty, and by the time they get out here, they're mad. And then, you know, the end of the road has been privately developed. There's a charge for parking there. There isn't really anything to see. They don't understand how the tram system works. And I think it's frustrating for people now. I enjoy the people that we have during the summer. I'd like to see it more a positive experience.
The change Critchin and others have grown to accept is underway. A footbridge will largely replace the tram as the way across the Kennecott River by next fall. And the McCarthy Road is currently being studied for upgrade. So far, plans call for widening the road to 24 feet, improving its surface with gravel or pavement, sprinkling it with waysides and trailheads, and adding a multi-use trail along the road's shoulder. National Park Service landscape architect Ken Pendleton heads an interagency team working on the upgrade plan for the Alaska Department of Transportation.
And our objective has been to create a scenic corridor with a focus on upgrading the road for safety improvements, but just as importantly, also provide improvements, necessary improvements for public use and enjoyment along the road. So our task was to look at the road corridor to see if we could plan for, you know, restrooms, toilets, trash collection, and create some opportunities for visitors to enjoy the country between Chittenden and McCarthy.
Pendleton says the state road improvements are not designed to take business away from McCarthy and Chittenden, and that there will be no fee or permit system for the improved road. The upgrade will mean more and larger recreational vehicles on the road, and the speed limit will remain 40 miles per hour maximum. But the design team reports little opposition to their plan. Co-editor of the Wrangell-St. Elias News, Rick Kenyon, characterizes those tired of talking about the road. With so many visitors and an economy based on tourism, Kenyon says change is inevitable.
I am sick and tired of meetings. We've had meetings, we've had studies. They've been studying this stupid road since 1955. I'd just like to see them spend half the money that they've used studying it and holding meetings to fill in the potholes.
Kenyon won't get his wish. The approval process for the $25 to $30 million upgrade is creeping along with the Federal Highway Administration. The DOT estimates work could begin at earliest in 1999. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
It's called REP, the Rural Educator Preparation Partnership. Located at UAF, it will bring future teachers, school district administrators, and education professors together. Director John Antonin, who was appointed last week, says the REP will prepare Native educators for work at all of Alaska's schools.
In the case of, say, a student in Bethel, who is a teacher aide there and had some coursework on the way to becoming a teacher but has not gotten that far, they would be in a REP program, which is a specifically aimed at teacher training, and they would be working with the already certified teachers out there on teacher identified teacher skills, and those teachers out there would be partnering with the university personnel to deliver a competency-based program to those individuals.
Antonin says that Bethel student might take some classes at UAF, but most of the training would take place on site. And he says the partnerships would change depending on where the prospective teachers live. As the teachers prove their competency, Antonin says they should step into available jobs. Fairbanks North Star Borough School Superintendent John Monahan says his staff should reflect the diversity of the district's students, and he says the rep could increase native hire in urban districts by upping the number of applicants.
All the school districts across Alaska and across the United States are competing for some of the same people. And the more applicants that John's able to foster and the communities are able to foster, then it creates an applicant pool. So we have a better chance of hiring, 20 or 30, individuals.
The district's coordinator for Alaska Native Education says she'll be watching to see if the rep produces more Native teachers. Eleanor Lachlan says she has reservations about the possibility of sacrificing standards just to increase numbers.
My concern is that because of the high turnover rate of teachers in rural Alaska, that if they just get any teacher to be the head teacher of this age, I think it could be a problem. I think the program needs to look for a mentor type of teacher that has longevity in a school and that's been around the district for a while and that's aware of what's happening. Otherwise I'm afraid that, there'll be a lot of disappointments.
Director Antonin says the state's still finalizing competency standards for the program. He says another benefit of the partnerships will be teachers trained with the cultural literacy expected in each geographic region of the state. For example, he says the cultural literacy requirements of Kluwak would be different from those of Barrow.
Where Inupiaq language is still alive, that local partnership may say some fluency in Inupiaq is what we want our teachers to have. But in Kluwak, they may not want a fluency in Tlingit, but they may want them to, for example, to know, say, 500 place, Tlingit place names, geographical place names. Or I'm just saying that those kinds of outcomes can be established in the local partnership.
Antonin moves to Fairbanks to set up his office in January. He says one of his first tasks will be looking for grants to help fund the program. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
We're delighted that they've been able to come up with that, with those that have been involved in that dastardly deed, although saddened by the fact that it had to happen and people have to do that sort of thing.
A team of scientists and engineers visited McGrath last Tuesday in the final stage of a two-year feasibility study to determine if electrical power generated by fluidized bed combustion makes sense for McGrath. Mike Jones with the Energy and Environmental Research Center of the University of North Dakota says the team toured the McGrath area, including possible sites for the combustor. They also visited Little Tanzana, where the coal mine would be located.
McGrath was chosen for very good reasons in terms of the stability and the importance of this village to this part of Alaska. The fact that there are coal deposits in the region was certainly a factor.
The combustor would end McGrath's dependence on diesel fuel to run the utility's electrical generator. Not only coal could be burned, but wood byproducts and peat, all found in abundance in the McGrath area. Eventually, even municipal garbage could be used as a fuel source. According to Mike Jones, fluidized bed combustion is a very clean burning system.
We do not expect to see any significant emissions from this system. I would venture to guess that you would have lower emissions from this than you would have from diesel systems currently operating.
If the go-ahead for construction is given, two buildings approximately 60 by 80 and about six stories high would be built to house the combustor and coal. The smokestack would rise about 80 feet. A coal mining operation would be established on Doyen lands at Little Tanzana. The mine would be open every other year during the winter months. The coal would be hauled to McGrath on a winter road. Mike Jones is optimistic the project will go forward.
Nothing we've seen to date has changed our ideas. We think it's a very good site. Yes, there are going to be some decisions left to be made, and that will happen over.
cooperative of the McGrath Area Local Native Corporation. MTNT owns the electrical utility which serves McGrath. If the project is given the green light, construction would begin in about a year and be completed by the year 2000. In McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
They're called PLBs, personal locator beacons. There's a good chance an Alaska State Trooper's office near you has one. The troopers bought 21 of the beacons and distributed them throughout the state, including one to Galena. Galena Trooper Burke Barrick says, considering the low population of the area, we're fortunate to have one.
Then they can take this thing along with them. If they have a problem, they activate it, and it is picked up by a satellite and forwarded to a receiving station on the East Coast, and then they call RCC in Alaska. And because this thing actually has a unique identifier on it, they can tell exactly which unit has been activated.
When a beacon is activated and the transmission relayed through the satellite, an Air Force rescue helicopter lifts off from either Fairbanks or Anchorage to locate the lost person. The PLBs are designed to work at 40 below zero for at least 24 hours. Like all technology, it isn't all you should depend on. Trooper Barrick says anyone heading into the bush should have appropriate survival gear with them to stay alive until help arrives. The PLB is about the size of a handheld walkie-talkie and only weighs a few pounds. The replacement cost for the unit is about $1,500. In the event of an actual rescue, Barrick says the state probably wouldn't try to recover the cost of the operation. But if someone had a false alarm activation, they would be held responsible. While the PLBs are a recent acquisition for the state troopers, the North Slope Borough has been using them for 5 years. Search and Rescue Coordinator Hugh Pukatuk says that North Slope was chosen as a test site for the PLBs because of its size, remoteness, and weather extremes.
A group of these nations got together somehow or another to see whether these personal locator beacons would work. And it was, since we're in a, kind of like a remote area, not too populated, and it's kind of spread wide open, it's an ideal place to test this sort of equipment.
The North Slope Borough has 80 of the units throughout the villages, and they plan to buy 80 more. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
Bird Girl awoke with her head upside down in a fog of pain. She realized she was being carried over the shoulder of her captor as if she were a large piece of caribou meat wrapped in its own hide. Her hands and feet were tightly bound. A strip of skin had been tied over her mouth. She felt suffocated and trapped. For a moment, she knew what an animal must feel when it is about to die.
In the story of Bird Girl and the Man Who Followed the Sun, Wallace introduces two Gwich'in characters to each other. They're both independent souls who defy tradition. Bird Girl leaves her family to explore the life of a hunter, while Dago decides to find where the sun goes each winter. After living with different cultures, one as a prisoner and the other a guest, they both try to get back home. Wallace says the story challenges the notion that indigenous people are just a part of the landscape discovered by the Western world.
The stuff that I learned in school was Columbus was the first one to have discovered this side of the world, and before that, the indigenous people were just kind of like one with the animals of the land, so that people didn't think of them as explorers, you know. And so when I heard Dago, the Man Who Followed the Sun, I said, here's Christopher Columbus, you know, an explorer.
The choices Bird Girl and Dago made led to periods of solitude, virtually unknown in tight-knit Athabascan communities. Like her characters, it's a choice Wallace has made herself. She grew up a loner, a middle child in a family of 13, and later as a teenager, she decided not to hang out with the rest of the crowd, which would mean drinking.
After my father died, I had made a choice to be a loner, or else I either became a loner or I became one with the flock, and in the end, the result is to die. For me, an easy choice, because my father, I watched him kill himself with alcohol, and my mother at that time was killing herself. So for me, it was... the pressure was there, you know, and it was very painful being a loner at that time, because there was just me and my brothers and whoever else was not drinking, but there were very few of us. So in that sense, I became a loner.
Wallace wrote her first book, Two Old Women, because she was afraid her mother would die and her stories would too. She's always sure to acknowledge her mom, who's sober now, as the original teller of the tales in her books. But she knows she's added a part of herself to them.
Two Legends and also in Two Old Women, the story was never to give up, you know, always to keep walking. One step brings you closer, you know, and I talked about how I used to walk 24 miles a day. And I used my little sister was my little companion. She was sometimes 9 years old at one point. And she would get really tired, and I would tell her, one step brings us closer, you know. And you know, that was just a thing that people used to learn a long time ago.
Wallace says these Gwich'in stories still have lessons to teach today, and by putting them on paper, she's giving her children a chance to hear them. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher. I'm Teresa Bacher. Proposition questions on the Fairbanks city and borough ballots overshadowed the races for local government seats, but a close one did stand out. It looks like incumbent John Immel won the race for City Council seat E against Shirley Dementev by just over 100 votes. The challenger outspent Immel by more than $3,000. Dementev says she was disappointed that he didn't campaign, but that didn't stop her from walking away with a positive feeling.
We talked to as many people as we could, and I really hope that it made some people think and realize that there are some issues that affect Fairbanks, that affect all of us, and I hope that through my campaign people realize that you don't have to be rich or famous in order to run a campaign here in Fairbanks. You just have to have a mind and know how to speak it.
Immel's victory won't be official until all the absentee and question ballots are counted. An incumbent also won the other city council race. Jerry Cleworth took just over 63% of the votes in his contest with Frank Turney. Four Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly seats were up for grabs this year. The race for seat J between Esther resident Cole Sonnefrank and Douglas Boyer was the closest. 51% of the voters chose Sonnefrank, who says he had to overcome a liberal brand.
Some folks have me pegged way out there, different from where I am, so they expect me to be a tax and spend liberal, whatever exactly that means, and I'm not. I mean, it's that simple. So to get people to appreciate that and vote that way is a challenge.
In the other borough assembly seat races, seat K incumbent Dan Lasota paddled by Cameron Carter with just under 60% of the votes. Nancy Webb sailed by Scott Calder in the race for seat E with 65%, and Guy Satley took the three-way race for seat D with just under 50%. Candidates raced for three seats on the Fairbanks North Star Borough School Board. Incumbent Bill Burrows beat Sally Shostall with 55% of the votes. Jane Parrish took the four-way race for seat F with 40%, while Bob Sawyer's 27% made him the closest challenger. And Jennifer Schmidt won the right to represent seat G with just about 43% of the votes. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher. Rod and Christy Mortz moved to Alaska 3 years ago. They wanted to live out the Alaskan dream, find a spot with a view of a river, and build a house. They looked around and discovered the Haystack Mountain area, about 20 miles outside of Fairbanks on the Elliott Highway. They checked with the borough and found out it wasn't available for purchase. So they made a special request to the borough assembly, asking them to spend the money to survey the land and make lots available for auction. The assembly said yes, and the Mortzes got their land. But Rod Mortz says they were lucky.
It's kind of tough to get the land that you really want. It's kind of up to them which land gets disposed. We found it in a year, talked to them, went through the process. During the auction, we got it, and I guess we owned it probably about, 13, 14 months later. It's kind of a tough process to go through because you can't just go in and say, we want it.
Land Management Director Paul Costello says the borough is trying to change that. It wants to involve the public in the land selection process from the beginning to make it easier for people like the Mortzes.
We have not gone to the public since the late 80s and asked for nominations and then sat down with the public once the nominations have been advertised and go back over what we think ought to happen in light of what they've proposed to us.
For example, Costello says the borough has two parcels in the Two Rivers area which might be attractive to potential homebuyers, but roads and access across private property might be needed, and that costs money.
And once we do get to it, then how do we subdivide it, or do we subdivide it? Title 17 says that we have to subdivide, but the question is, and it's a fair question for the residents to ask, is should the borough be doing that subdivision, or should we contract that out to private subdividers, or should we sell the parcel in total and let somebody else take care of it? That's basically the kind of questions that we're looking at right now.
Residents have until the end of the year to nominate parcels of land, and then planners will analyze each. They'll decide if the land's right for housing or commercial use and what the borough will have to spend to prepare it. A series of public hearings will be held this spring to review the findings. Costello says land should be available for purchase by the end of the summer of 98. Today, Rod and Christy Mortz are clearing the land on their parcel for a house pad. They've been working in phases to avoid large debts and expect to be moved into their Alaskan dream home before the snow flies next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Valley High School teacher Mike Leslie is looking forward to caller ID. The service will let him see who's calling and reveal the caller's phone number. On occasion, Leslie's been troubled by anonymous calls from irate students, but he's less concerned for himself than for his teenage daughter.
I've received a phone call at 1:30 in the morning where a bunch of boys who have spent the night together decided to let me know what things my daughter would like to do to them. And they wouldn't leave their name, and then they hung up.
Starting in November, Leslie can pay $6 a month, rent or buy equipment which attaches to his phone, and discover who is calling him. He hopes that will eliminate unwanted calls. Sandy Samaniego is the executive director of the local Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance. She, too, welcomes the caller ID service, saying when it came to Anchorage, it reduced harassing calls made to the shelter there. And she adds, there are other benefits.
Hopefully, we'll be able to find out where a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault is calling from, because sometimes, you know, you get accidentally disconnected, or the domestic violence may be occurring and the victim is forced to hang up. And so in those events, it's always been frustrating that we haven't always been able to at least figure out where the call was coming from.
Samaniego sees caller ID as a boon for women or anyone plagued with abusive callers. Judith DeCue of Clark University doesn't argue. She agrees the technology will help many. But as a professor who studied the issue, she says there are many who see caller ID as an assault on privacy. She says it may discourage some from anonymously reporting crimes or industrial abuses.
And actually, a much more normal reason is that none of us really want our number, or I think very few of us want our number automatically made available to anybody we call, because now if you make a phone call to a catalog to purchase something, for example, the catalog, if they have caller ID, automatically gets your name, your number, and they can hook that up to a computer data bank that gives them huge amounts of information about you, your credit history, and your employment, maybe even your medical records.
But DeCue says there are ways to protect privacy. Phone companies offering caller ID must also offer a way to block identification. That's what MUS is doing, either permanently or on a call-by-call basis. There are also other options available with the new technology, but at a price. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.